Hello and welcome back to Pop Break TV's brand new Sometimes podcast, Saturday Morning Adventures, where contributors to thepopbreak.com and their friends kick back, tune in, and zone out to the kids' cartoons that define their childhood and the ones that still give them life to this day. My name is Alex Marcus, podcasting director of thepopbreak.com, and today we're here to discuss the epic two-episode premiere of X-Men 97, the sequel series to the 1992 X-Men the Animated Series. To help me jump back in time to the 90s, I am joined by the host of the Lost Spaces podcast, Kay Anderson. Now, Kay, thank you so much for joining me again. And before we get started, I need to know, have you recovered from Gambit's crop top in the kitchen, episode one?
I think we need to petition Marvel to have Gambit's uniform officially changed to the crop top.
Absolutely. I just like the fact that as soon as that started, I was like, we're going to have a week-long conversation about cum gutters as it relates to the X-Men cartoon. It's like, this is exactly what I was hoping would happen.
It was so random. Yeah, that was so random. I mean, I know. Yeah. Anyway, okay, sorry. Let's not get focused on his navel.
It's hard not to. He is known by many as sort of like the Kickstarter of many a bisexual awakening. And I totally appreciate them leaning directly into the skit on that one in the opening minutes of this episode. But yeah, so we're here to talk about the first two episodes of this show. It dropped this week. We've been waiting for this for so long. They originally announced that this was happening years ago. We spent probably about a full year, the two of us, talking about whenever it drops, we're going to do a podcast about it. And then we never knew when it was. And now we're finally here and we've watched the episode. So before we like get started, we're going to, our plan for the episode is, instead of breaking it down at plot by plot, scene by scene, over the course of the two episodes, we're just going to kind of check in with all of the major characters and what the main storylines are. But before we do that, just, you know, we've been waiting for so long for this. Kay, how did you feel watching it?
God. Okay, so first of all, I need to just say that I am one of those annoying people that when everyone is like, wow, this is amazing, I'm like, is it? So I need to just like embrace that and accept that I've got a bit of a tinge of contrarianism. Got that running through my veins. So I wasn't like disappointed at all with the episodes, but every review and every kind of piece of hype that leading up to it was like, these are amazing, they're great. And I think that might have tainted it a little because I was just, well, no, I wasn't just whelmed. I'm like leaning on the positive side. I enjoyed them a lot. But I wasn't like, wow, I'm 10 again.
Well, that's fair. I think it would be pretty hard to feel like you were 10 again. So if that is the expectation, it's hard to hit it.
Well, how did you find them?
So I watched this last night and I also saw all of those reviews. And that also made me worried because it, you know, especially with a certain segment of the critical community online, especially when it comes to like nerd culture stuff and everything, there's like a segment of reviews that always come out. When those specific critics see it, the critics that the studio gives the stuff early to, which is always kind of like a red flag.
Carry page.
So, yeah, exactly. So when those people see it, but before we get to see it, there's always this kind of wave of like, this is the most amazing thing that's ever happened. And I remember like when Ant-Man Quantumania came out, there was some guy who was like, Marvel finally did it. It's their Star Wars. And it's like, man, nothing could ever be further from the truth. So you always kind of have to like ratchet down expectations once they start getting pumped up like that. And so I went into that and I tried to like really just like take it all out of my mind, just be like, I'm just watching this show that is made for both like 30-year-olds and also like 9-year-olds, I guess. So it's like, what could this actually be? How can it manage to satisfy both audiences that it's going for? And I'll say, after two episodes, I was impressed. Like when we looked at it in the trailers, we looked at it in some of the stills, we thought, oh, it looks really different from what we were used to. I kind of feel like they, in motion, in universe, it actually did kind of feel like a nice balance between old and new in that respect. I thought that the voice acting all pretty much hit the way that I was hoping. There were, you know, the Wolverine and Rogue sound a little bit older than they used to, but I feel like I settled into that pretty easily. And I just loved that they went deeper and harder than I was afraid that they might. It would be very easy for them to just like play the hits, be like, oh, it's characters that you like and they're doing stuff, they're beating up robots, you love it. But I feel like they actually decided to focus on some interesting storylines that we'll get into, and they willing to play some of the messy soap opera love triangle stuff that I was coming for, and they're finding comic book storylines that they could tell in single episodes that I thought both inform the characters in interesting ways and are fun to watch. So I found it like met all of my expectations. I was very happy to watch it. Definitely not a perfect show, right? It's not like going to be like my favorite show of the year, I don't think. I just don't think that that's the type of show that it is. But for what I was hoping for, I feel like I left very satisfied.
I totally agree with you on the animation. Like, I was a bit worried that I would find it too jarring, but like just very quickly just forgot the comparisons with the original show. The voice actors, my mind, like, I'm just wigging out that all of the voice actors that I have the most problems with because they sound too different from the originals actually happen to be the originals. Because Rogue, I was just like, Rogue, you sound so stupid. This isn't Rogue. This is stupid. And then I found out that it was the same voice actor. And I just, yeah, I don't know. Maybe they should have just recast. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to like put those actors out of jobs, but that was a weird thing for me. But this is the kind of show that I would have valued having all the episodes drop at once. Because I think it's one of those shows that I would have really just liked to just cycle my way through and get through all the stories. And I think it's going to be hard for me to do weekly.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. I find that that is often the case with animated shows that I watch because... It sometimes feels like there's not as much to dig into for a week-to-week watch. This time we got two episodes, so that was good. What I was surprised by, I'll just say, is these episodes are long. It's like each episode was over 30 minutes. I wasn't expecting that.
And they cram a lot in.
Do you think that they like made the most of that time, or do you think that they kind of were a little too overambitious with it?
Well, I don't know. See, I mean, this is the thing as well. I think like I won't have a proper opinion about this show until the end of the series because I want to see like where all these threads are leading to. At the moment, it's like, holy shit, they put a lot of content in those things and they've kickstarted lots of storylines. But maybe that makes sense and it will all like, I'll be satisfied by that by the end of episode 10.
So that'll be a fun subplot for our listeners to listen to, is if over the course of each episode reaction that we're doing, if you feel more and more comfortable with giving your actual opinion on the episode.
Oh, sorry. Am I being too like, maybe.
No, that's perfect.
I just want to see about Rogue and Magneto boning, really. That's thing.
Well, and that's, so I think that it's interesting that you say that because I think that if you think about the original series and you think about how cartoons were back then, you definitely wouldn't have ever said, I need to watch the whole season before I can judge whether I like this or not, right? But this show, while really paying tribute to what came before it, is kind of set up as like a serialized show where you're setting up a lot of dominoes that are going to start following throughout this season. And let's just start off with the first one that comes to mind, which is the Scott and Jean piece, right? Scott and Jean. Jean is pregnant. That's a new status quo. Scott and Jean are thinking about leaving the X-Men to start a family of their own, right? There's all of this tension because Jean is stressed out about the baby. What's the baby going to be like? Do I want him to be born a mutant? Do I not want him to be born a mutant? Do I want him to grow up in this atmosphere that we grew up in? Do I want safety and security for him? And Scott is really torn between the kind of survivor guilt of that he has for being Charles' prodigal son, you know, now that Professor Xavier is dead, and then the complication that gets thrown in the second episode of Magneto being the one that is going to be in charge of the team if Scott leaves. All of that stuff, there's tension that plays out and informs the specific episodes that we watch, but it's clear that's going to be building throughout the whole season, especially once we get to the cliffhanger of episode two. Where we get a second Jean.
Oh, wait a minute. Maybe Jean isn't Jean after all. Yeah.
So what do you think of all that? I mean, there's a lot of stuff there to dig into.
Yeah, I think... Okay, so my initial impressions, I was a bit put off by the characterization of Scott. Because he came in, there was one line I wrote down where he was like, I'm definitely one of the good guys. And it just felt so arrogant and like so at odds with the earnestness and seriousness of Cyclops as a character. So in the first episode, I was really like, oh. But then when he got totally butthurt and introspective about the fact that Xavier had left the school to Magneto, I was like, oh, okay, this is the Scott I know. But I felt like that was a bit of a misstep in introducing him because it kind of didn't I don't feel it represented the essence of Scott. I felt like it was a weird thing. And he also said, like, when he had his visor knocked off, he was like, oh, no, not. And then, like, thing. And I get it, because it was a 90s reference and it was something that people would say then. But yeah. I don't think Scott would ever say that. Anyway, so that's my take on that.
I love that we're podcasting about this together, because we have, like, such different opinions on what happened. I really like the way that they introduced Scott, because I feel like Scott in the X-Men cartoon from the 90s, especially, he has this reputation for being super, like, haughty and arrogant and, like, just really kind of, like, unbelievably insensitive, just, like, barrels into rooms, yells at people, makes them do stuff, and everybody kind of, like, doesn't like him. And I think that that actually impacted general understanding of the character in a way where people who would read the comics would be like, no, this is actually, like, an incredibly compelling character who is a lot of depth and is not just, like, this Boy Scout who's, like, rude to everybody because they don't respect that he's in charge. But in the 90s cartoon, a lot of the times that would happen. I'm thinking of, like, there was one episode that I watched in my rewatch last year where he, like, goes to this abandoned town and he's, like, looking for this, like, old, like, friend of his who has gone off the grid, and he thinks that something terrible has happened, and he, like, runs into this, like, doctor, and he just starts yelling at him. He's like, you've ruined the whole town. You have to get up, stand up and do something. It's like, meanwhile, like, the whole town is, like, being held hostage by these, like, evil mutants, and this guy is, like, his life is in danger, and he's, like, Scott, like, doesn't care, because all he cares about is, like, what's right and wrong, and he's just, like, so rude to him. But, like, for the right reasons, you know? And, like, that, yeah, I think, is how people think about that character from the cartoon.
You used the word arrogant there, though. Like, I wouldn't say that was arrogance. I just would say that that was, like, an overly strong moral compass that means he's not cued into social.
Yeah, I guess I read that a little bit as arrogant in the sense of, like, he's not taking any time to, like, account for what's going on with this person. He's not meeting them with any sort of empathy or consideration. He's just, like, arrogantly charging into the room and, like, demanding that this person does what he thinks is the right thing, and without, like, even, and, like, really berating him in a way that has made me laugh when I watched it the first time. He was like, this is ridiculous. Given that context, I like that they kind of start out there in that opening sequence where he is sort of, like, very, you know, brash. And then I like that over the course of that episode, the writers deepen his character. They let him have these complications. They let him feel a lot more like the Scott Summers that people know from the comics, and not so much from the movies, because the movies, I think we all can agree, kind of botched that character.
He just disappears halfway through the second film or the third. Anyway,
no, in the third film he gets one scene, and then he, like, goes up to the lake and he gets disintegrated. That's it for Scott. But yeah, and the prequel movies don't really treat him much better, unfortunately. So in the general culture, there isn't this real awareness that Scott Summers is actually an incredibly compelling and complex character. So I like that we start out with that sort of, you know, meta wink of, like, oh, you know this guy, he's kind of a dick. And then over the course of 30 minutes, actually, he's this, like, really complicated figure who has all of these different emotional pulls at him, and he feels this responsibility to lead the team, a team that, like, doesn't always respect the fact that he feels like he's the one who has to lead them, right? And he loves his wife, he loves Jean, he wants to have a family with her, but how is that going to fit with this, like, the weight of all of this guilt and grief and all of that that lies underneath it, and then the mistrust of Magneto and all. So I feel like it really helps layer the character in a way that makes him much more interesting by the end of the second episode.
Yes, yeah, I totally agree. But I still stand by my point that in the first scene, that does not feel like Cyclops at all. He just needs to be, like, overly serious and, like, not have a sense of fun. Like, that's kind of his MO, right?
Yeah, the not joke is the thing that you're pushing up against the most. And I get that. The only way that Scott Summers would make a joke like that is if it was, like, 30 years out of fashion.
Yeah. Well, this, sorry to jump ahead with this, but there's also something in me that thinks, like, Scott Summer would never leave the scene of an insurrection for any reason. Which I hadn't really thought about until now.
But he might do it because of that obligation that he feels towards Jean. What I like about that moment is that they don't really give him a choice. He doesn't say, I need to get to Jean. He says, Jean's in labor. And then Storm is like, Rogue, get Cyclops to Jean.
Everyone goes.
And he doesn't even have time to really think. I think if the call was his, he probably would have felt a lot of anguish and then stayed. But the call isn't really his. It's his friends who make him do what they know is the right thing for him, which is like an interesting kind of commentary on how they are such a good family unit, you know? Mm-hmm. But speaking of that pregnancy bomb that goes off in the second episode, we're going to talk about Jean now. How are you feeling about the presentation of Jean?
I feel okay. So I need to be like totally upfront and say that Scott and Jean are like the least interesting characters to me. And maybe that's just like a hangover from them seeming like old and fusty when I was a kid. But I'm never really like rooting for them or in their corner or like that interested in what's going on. I think there's also this weird good girl thing about Jean that I find a bit annoying sometimes.
Yeah, I think that Jean as a character is so interesting because I always think of her as like this, like, you know, universe destroying person, right? Somebody who's capable of an incredible power, both as a mutant on her own and then with Phoenix supercharging her and everything, and, you know, the anguish of her dying and coming back to life and all that stuff. But in the cartoon, most of the time she's just kind of like holding her temple and then passing out, right? Like, that's a lot of Jean for a long time in this animated series is that. So
and giving Wolverine blue balls.
Right, that's true. It's, you can never forget that they actually go there in the show. Which we, I love that we continue here. But yeah, so I don't think she's really that developed of a character in this universe. And so it's interesting to see we jump a year from when we saw her last and suddenly she's pregnant. She has all of these complicated relationships with all of these people who it was kind of hinted to at various points, but I feel like we're really getting it more here. Like that relationship with her and Storm, which is so important in the comics, we're getting it a lot stronger than I think we ever did in the original run. The way in which Scott is the leader of the team, but Jean is the one who wears the pants in that relationship is something that I really like about their dynamic, even though they can be kind of boring. I don't disagree with you on that. It's just like, you know, so much guilt and anguish for no real reason. And then, you know, the thing I love about Scott Summers is that, like, so Jean dies tragically in the comic books and he like fucks off to Alaska because he's like, I can't handle my feelings, I need to go to Alaska. And then he meets someone who looks identical to Jean Grey and like never puts two and two together and like marries her and has a kid. So I love that. I'm curious how this Jean Grey seeming clone that we get at the end, or I'm curious how this is going to play out in this universe, how much of it they're going to take and how much they're going to like mix up. But I thought that as a character here in these two episodes, I thought that they gave her just enough to do to make me want to see what happens next, and just enough for me to feel like the connection she has with Scott is interesting. The connection that she has with Wolverine is interesting. And I'm very curious where it goes, right? I don't think that we get a ton outside of those things, but from what we get, I'm curious to see where we move forward, especially with the big cliffhanger at the end of the episode.
Yeah. Do you have any theories on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously Madeline Pryor, right, is the thing that comes to mind first.
But which one is Madeline Pryor?
Right, that's the interesting question. Like, what do we find out that actually the body that after Phoenix died, like after Phoenix releases Jean Grey, like do we find out, oh, that wasn't really, that's like a new body that's not really Jean, and or is Madeline Pryor this person coming and she's just like escaping Sinister's laboratory or something? You know, like I'm very curious. What do you think is going to happen?
I think that the Jean that we've just spent the last two episodes with is Madeline Pryor.
Okay. That would be very interesting.
But I'm not the person that's rewatched the cartoon recently. So how did they resolve the Phoenix saga there?
So in the original cartoon, the way they resolve the Phoenix saga is Jean, in order to free herself of the Phoenix Force, because the Phoenix Force is going to destroy the universe if they don't stop it.
Yeah.
And the Shi'ar Empire wants to destroy her, but the X-Men won't let them. And then Jean is like, please, you have to kill me. It's the only way. And then Scott Summers is like, I can't. And Wolverine is like, I can't. And so then she's like, fine, I'll do it myself. And she basically like hijacks a Shi'ar laser and blows herself up. And then everyone's like, oh no, Jean's dead. And then all of a sudden the Phoenix Flare comes up and he's like, this amazing woman, Jean Grey, sacrificed herself for the good of all people. And now that I'm not in her body, it turns out I'm not crazy anymore. So she can live again as long as you sacrifice a spark from your life and force. And so then that's, so then all of the X-Men stand around in a circle and give a piece of their life force to the body of Jean Grey. And then she is awoken again. And then the Phoenix Force just like flies off into the cosmos. That's the end of the episode.
Do they all understand like the price they pay by giving a piece of their soul?
Yes, well, because Scott and Wolverine briefly argue over who is going to be the one to sacrifice themselves to bring Jean back, and then the Phoenix Force is like, it could actually be a small piece of all of you if you'd like, and then they're like, okay, fine, we'll do that. So it's like a little bit of their life force comes. So it would be interesting if maybe like they do something where actually like they gave too much of their life force and it created like a twinning effect in their soul. So that created two genes and one has been held captive on the moon or something. I don't know.
I see. Oh, yeah. I was just thinking like, you know, they've all got chronic fatigue syndrome now because they've given too much of their soul away.
Oh, sure.
I'm not sure why I'm making a connection between chronic fatigue syndrome and your soul. So sorry if anyone out there has chronic fatigue syndrome. And I'm just really
he's not calling you soulless. He's just saying a small piece of your soul is gone.
Which would make you tired. That's my assumption. It would make you tired rather than making you evil. So, right. I mean, that's something, right?
Absolutely.
Anyway.
Yeah, so we were talking about how that could possibly connect to Madeline Pryor popping up on Earth. I don't know. I think it would be tough to connect that back to where we came from. But we could have a moment where, like, the way that Jean Grey comes back in the comics is that they realize that, oh, Phoenix actually didn't possess Jean Grey's body. Phoenix created a new Jean Grey body to live inside, and the real Jean Grey was
at the bottom of the ocean.
In the bottom of Jamaica Bay in Queens. So it could be that that also happened here, and the Jean Grey that was saved on the moon was always a like a clone created by the Phoenix Force, and that this is the original Jean Grey that's just finally rising from the lake.
Hard pill to swallow, that one. I'm not sure if I was the writer of this show, I'd be like, yes, we need to weave this story in somehow.
Yeah, I guess my question would be like, where is it that you want to take a reveal like that, right? I feel like if the answer is, it turns out the real Jean Grey was in the bottom of a lake for the last 10 years, that has some story potential, but not a ton. So like, what would maybe be better? I don't know. Maybe the reveal that went, because in this universe, at one point during what was supposed to be their original wedding, Mr. Sinister kidnaps them and steals some of their genetic material. So maybe there'll be a reveal that Madeline Pryor got swapped out in that moment and the real Jean Grey has been in prison with Sinister this whole time.
Okay. Yeah, that could happen. The most important question here, though, is...
Yes.
How would you feel if your partner had a clone? Is that exciting to you?
If they were cool with it, I would be cool with it, I guess.
Would you try and initiate a threesome?
I mean, it doesn't even really count as a threesome, right? Because it's just like two of the same person. So it's like, it's not even cheating.
Oh.
I think it would really be like, I would be game with whatever you guys wanted to work out. You'd have to talk to each other about it. And when you settle on a decision, I'd be okay with it. Because from my perspective, it's two people that, it's one person that I love in two different bodies. What's better? That means that I can have one that, you know, goes with me to the movies and another one that, like, you know, I don't know. But I'm just saying, sometimes you want a partner who can support you in all things, and that's unrealistic, right? Because, you know, they have their own needs. And if you could just swap out two versions of that partner, then their needs could be satisfied and, you know, they could get their alone time and their together time.
Or they'd have two sets of needs that are just like doubly draining.
Well, that would be extra draining for me, I suppose. But I'm kind of like a codependent people-pleasing person. So I think that that would probably like hit my sweet spot in a way that would be not good for me mentally, but would feel good at the moment.
Well, if that ever does happen and you're dating a clone, two clones? No, one original and one clone, then... let me know.
I will definitely let you know. I feel like the honest answer is that I would probably start to have like feel like the clone is like the underdog that I have to like empathize more with, and I would probably end up being the clone. It's not his fault that he's a clone, you know?
Well, yeah, but do you not have any loyalty to the original?
But isn't he also, the clone is also the original as far as he's concerned. This is good. We should talk about this more maybe over the course of this season. But for now, let's move on to a discussion of a threesome that we all would love to see on the show, which is, of course, the Wolverine of it all. And I pair him up here with Morph, because Morph is just his good buddy as far as we're concerned in these two episodes. And I love that for them, because in the very first episode of the original X-Men, Morph is portrayed as Wolverine's best friend in the whole world, even though before that moment Morph had never
existed.
Exactly. But in this moment, it's he's Wolverine's best friend, and then immediately
they jump in.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because as we know at this point in continuity, and for this show in particular, they've defined Morph as non-binary, which makes sense because they are a shapeshifter and they could present in any way that they feel like at any given point. So we got a lot of really fun Morph action in these two episodes, and we got most of all this great relationship that actually pays off the kind of like Wolverine screaming Morph in the first episode in 1992. Now we know why they were such good friends, because Morph totally negged him and talked down to him all the time. Blew up his spot in public.
Wolverine was kind of underutilized. I mean, he was obviously there, and he wasn't as underutilized as other characters, which I think we might get to. But I was probably expecting more of Wolverine, just because Wolverine is like so omnipresent whenever you talk about the X-Men. So I'm actually quite glad of that he was just kind of like a supporting character and not featured too prominently. I love what they've done with Morph. I mean, bringing Morph more to the comic book version, which I know comes after the animated version, but like had more of an opportunity to be fleshed out and for like them to have fun with. The voice actor, what are your thoughts on Morph? It kind of makes sense because it is just a different character.
Yeah, I'll be honest, I never loved the original voice actor in the
role. Yeah.
The kind of like sticky sort of like comic joke guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not my favorite. Was really giving kind of like a penguin from the like 1960s Batman, you know? So I that's not my favorite thing. So in that sense, I wasn't really emotionally tied to that original portrayal. So I like what they're doing with the character here. And I do think that they explore their relationship interestingly. Morph still doesn't really feel well integrated into the team as a whole. But that's okay. You know, I don't feel like I need that. It could be that they are just really good friends with Wolverine and that they're just part of the team. I think we see in the opening credits, there's a tease to Morph facing off against Sinister again. And that's interesting. I'll be curious to see how that pays off later in the series. But I don't know. I think it's wild that Morph just straight up walks into a room as Professor Xavier when they're like, he died.
Yeah, it's kind of emotionally unintelligent, isn't it?
No. Do they realize how twisted that is? Because it feels like it feels like they're doing it kind of as a joke, but also like, but it's way worse than that.
But Professor X not included in what I'm about to say, it was really cool that Morph was able to just switch into all these characters. And I'm so excited about what characters they're just going to sneak in as like Morph turning into randomly for 3 seconds.
Were any of them really cool. Come to mind that you liked a lot?
Obviously seeing Psylocke just like kicking ass. Or do we call her Quanon now? I'm not sure. Anyway, I'm not sure where we're at in the continuity.
Here's the thing. Psylocke is an awesome character. I want Psylocke to only be presented as Morph, because then we don't have to deal with that question at all.
So yeah, was your psyche taken and put inside an assassin in some like convoluted way? No. Yeah, like we don't need to talk about that. Yeah, and Colossus, and when they turned into Archangel, and just every single character that they turned into, I was excited about.
Yeah, the Archangel thing took me a second. I was like, wait, did I miss that Archangel was on the plane? And I was like, oh. Right. Okay. Like that really took me a minute to process what was happening there.
But what obscure character do you think they could, are you most looking forward to them having Morph turn into?
Oh man. I mean, so as we saw, it seems like Morph can mimic powers also.
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, that's maybe a bit dodgy, but
Cause it's not really true, right? Isn't it?
I don't really know the science behind these things.
Yeah. Because if Morph can mimic character powers also, that really opens it up. Then I would love to see, like, Blink, where you can just, like, open portals. Because, I mean, that character's potential is so cool. And responsible for probably my favorite live-action action sequence of the X-Men film trilogy. Or film franchise, I should say. Mm-hmm. And Days of Future Past, the opening sequence when Blink is there and they're just, like, popping up and stuff. I love that portrayal. Mm-hmm. So that I would like to see as an obscure character. But man, I mean, X-Men has so many incredible obscure characters to choose from. So it'd be really tough. Maybe like one of the leprechauns that attacked the mansion in the 70s. That would be a fun obscure reference.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, we need to have a tracker and like keep up with all the characters that show up as.
Oh, that's a great idea. It's a recurring segment. Yeah.
But yeah, so, okay. So their friendship, I didn't really like pick up on it that much other than the scene in the tree. I wasn't really like.
Well, then there's the scene at the bar also where they're together and they're on a mission to recover Bobby DaCosta. And Morph is just completely giving Wolverine so much shit.
Oh, Morph is such a bitch. Yes, because Morph turns into Jean and then talks. Yeah. Oh, yes.
And then at one point, like, makes Jean's belly even more pregnant just to, like, rub it in his face. And, like, sure, he's saying that Scott sucks, so he's trying to be a good friend in that respect, but still, just, like, so rude. Like, and in public, too. Like, does the whole bar need to know about my business? The woman that I love is married to some dick I don't like?
Yeah. I'm gonna enjoy Morph. I know I'm gonna enjoy Morph.
Yeah,
just totally heartless.
Now, speaking of things that I enjoyed, I very much enjoyed that they made the choice to have Wolverine be the one at home with Jean when she goes into labor. I thought that was like a classic comedy moment in terms of like the least equipped man to have to deliver a child is put in that position. And so that was wonderful, in my opinion, the part where she's like, he's coming. And she's like, and Wolverine's like, who? Apocalypse? Like, no. Great moment. What did you think of all of that? The kind of like labor hijinks in the middle of cross-cutting between that and like a siege on the UN.
Yeah.
With a bunch of bigots.
But like, again, so this is me just being really nitpicky. I can't see Wolverine saying, oh, nah, I'll just stay at home.
He would stay home to protect Jean, I think.
Yeah, I can't see it. Because, I mean, if this was the 90s, they would just be like, Jubilee, you stay here, and we're gonna all go and save the world. You take care of the mansion.
That is definitely true. And then she'd be like, but Professor, I want to fly the plane.
Yeah. So I found it a bit weird that Wolverine was at home drawing on his heartstrings.
He cares a lot about Jean and wants to make sure that she's okay. And on the flip side, he definitely doesn't like Magneto and is not going to do any favors for Magneto if he doesn't have to. So if the position was like somebody has to stay home with Jean versus we're all going to go out to protect Magneto, like I feel like that's the choice that that character would make.
Yeah. It made sense. Okay, maybe. I can't imagine him not wanting to be in the center of the action.
Yeah, when it comes to ripping apart robots piece by piece, he doesn't hesitate to get on the flight. But when it comes to helping protect Magneto at a trial, like that seems really boring. He doesn't want to do that.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
Speaking of Magneto, we got a lot of Magneto stuff in the second episode, especially. Mm-hmm. We got a new character design, we got a new motivation, we got a slight personality shift. and a new philosophy. What did you think of the whole Magneto stuff and like kind of playing on the trial of Magneto, which is such a famous comic book arc from the 80s?
The one thing that has not changed about Magneto from the original incarnation of the show to this one is that he monologues a lot. Yeah. That was one of the things that I found like, yeah, is consistent with the original cartoon, but it's just not something that happens in TV shows anymore. And so it's a bit jarring, like both Magneto and Storm both just kind of like just went on monologues and it was just like, really? What? Who are you talking to? What's going on here? But anyway.
He still has his lovely locks, which is excellent. Yeah, he gets a new costume.
Yeah, fine. That costume, very, very 80s. I think, I'm really excited to see what happens with Magneto in this series. I think that there's the tension that is just so present in his situation, where he wants to honor his friend's wishes and do right by that. But he's also got lots of anger issues and thinks that the world would be better if he just smashed it up and started again. So balancing those two things is going to be tricky.
It is. I think that in order for them to sell his character well, and in a way that like works for people over the age of 10, which they're not under the obligation to do so, but it definitely seems like that's part of their ambition, I think you really need to make Magneto be a little bit of a softer character in the sense of wanting to live up to Charles's vision, right, out of respect. But you also have to present his former philosophy that obviously still he's emotionally invested in a way that the audience can get behind, where it's not just like, humans are terrible, we need to kill them because humanity is bad. Like, that is only going to go so far if you want to paint him as a sympathetic character. And I thought they did a lot of really good work in that effect when it came to the final big monologue that he has, where he kind of like takes the judges and the person who hurt Storm and took her powers away, kind of brings them up into the atmosphere and gives that monologue about the fury that he has, the way in which he feels like the deck is stacked against mutants and the bigotry of it all and all of that stuff. I thought that was a really powerful moment where it kind of channeled something that felt a lot more modern and a lot more politically relevant than I was expecting, which was a sense of like, why are we fighting so hard just to have the basic level of decency as an underrepresented, persecuted class of people? Like, I think one of his lines was, you don't need to accept us as equals, you just need to be willing to accept that we both live on this planet and have a right to do so, right? And I found that like really moving, especially from like a queer perspective, and thinking about the ways in which, like, not to get too serious, but like the ways in which so much like right-wing fanaticism lately has been geared around trying to make trans people and queer people just like no longer exist in public life anymore, because they're like, we're tired of being told that we have to tolerate you. We actually don't think we need to tolerate you. We think that you shouldn't exist at all. Like, we don't believe that you're real and we want you to go away, which is like awful. And I thought that moment where they kind of talk about like, you know, right now things are okay for mutants because it's sort of a passing fad, but I don't believe that that's going to stay the same because the bigotry is like so deeply rooted. And all that felt just very informed in like modern, you know, identity politics, I guess you could say, in a more broad sense. But just it really, as a queer person who has just been so horrified by the way in which this wave of anti-LGBT stuff has hit a lot of places, including the US and the UK. It just really spoke to me on that level. Did that connect at all with you?
Yeah, I mean, like, my thoughts on this are far less developed than yours. I was just thinking, they're probably not paying attention to you, Magneto, because they're shitting themselves that you like ripped them up out of their office and they're like hovering above the world. I don't think your message is getting across.
Fair enough. Although, in that moment, I guess all he really needs to get to sink in is that I can lift you up into the stratosphere whenever I want, so you should listen to what I say.
Yeah, but like, super weird that like after all of that happened, they were like, yep, cool, we're going to pardon you.
This is why we make a good podcast, because I'm like so like emotionally like in them, and you're just like very like, nope,
that wouldn't happen, what do you mean?
Speaking of something that I hope will happen is the whole tease of the backstory between Rogue and Magneto in this.
Yeah. You need to fill me in. Are Rogue and Gambit officially a couple by the end of series 5 of the animated series?
The whole entire run of that cartoon, it's very much like a flirty kind of like, I want to make like a chaste kiss sort of like, we should kiss because the world's going to end sort of deal. But it's all kind of like flirty back and forth.
But I can't because of my powers. Okay.
Exactly.
And so they never got beyond that then. So in this series, they're not a couple.
Not technically, although you could retcon it as them having been a couple, and it's just like that's their dynamic, it's just this sort of like flirt, because they can't be physically intimate regardless. So there's that, so you could kind of play it that way. It's very clear that they both care about each other a lot, they both want to be together, even though regardless of what their official status is. So
okay.
Building that into a love triangle between Rogue, Gambit, and Magneto is super interesting because there's a lot of kind of like interesting backstory with Rogue and Magneto in the comic books. And I mean, you've read a lot more of it than I have. So do you want to talk about that at all for people who might not be as familiar?
Yeah. See, I don't think I know. I don't think I remember this story because I don't think it lasted very long in terms of the romance between the two of them in the comic books. But there's certainly the connection because of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, which Rogue was a part of before she joined the X-Men. So they've got quite a long history.
Yeah. And so there's also like, there's a story, I forget exactly where in time it is, but there's a story where Rogue and Magneto end up in the Savage Land together, which for the uninitiated is this like tropical land of dinosaurs in the middle of the Arctic for some reason.
Of course. Yeah.
and they're kind of like stranded there for a while and they do kind of develop a sort of, romantic thing. Relationship, but then when they come home, it's not a part of their background. But then in the Age of Apocalypse miniseries, yes, when course, they're in the alternate universe and everything like that, she is paired with him. Like they're like a couple, like an established couple in that alternate universe. And they like have a kid together and stuff. And she and Magneto finds a way to block her powers so that way they can have a real relationship. And then after that, because that pairing was really popular, X-Men for a while did this thing where like original flavor Magneto was dead, but there was a clone of Magneto who popped up and didn't know who he was, and that person joined the X-Men and became part of a love triangle between Rogue and Gambit, and that was like a tension piece for a while in the mid-90s. And then
so this is the character that became Zorn.
I think so.
Okay.
I forget exactly how that resolves. But yeah, there's that piece of it too. So it feels like to me, they're kind of like pulling in all of those different influences and being like, there's a way that we can tell this type of love triangle story within our universe where it doesn't have to be so messy with continuity. And we can kind of just like vaguely call back to a past that we don't know.
Yeah. And I think it's super bold. I mean, going back to my point earlier, like they have thrown so much into these two episodes, but I think that was a really good choice of an avenue to pursue because it brings all of these different areas of tension.
Yeah. And as a modern viewer, there's only so far you can get with the Gambit Rogue flirty back and forth. Like you have to do something with it. And so if you're going to do something with it, why not throw this giant wrench in it where it's like Magneto has a secret past with Rogue and they have a secret like relationship that could then kindle. And the way in which they ground that, which is this story of how Rogue was, you know, her name's Rogue, right? She was a bad guy. She was a villain who the X-Men took in and rehabilitated. And now Magneto is in a similar position to have to be kind of rehabilitated and accepted by the X-Men. So they have this kind of connection in that way, which is in the present tense. And then you pair that with a potential past romantic relationship that really makes it messy and juicy in a way that I loved. I was not expecting them to go there at all. And I think it's really good. And also I think like pouty Gambit is a pretty good mode for Gambit because he's like so cocky that he like kind of needs to be put in his place a couple of times. So I like that as an unlikely trio.
I think my reading of Gambit is that the cockiness is a front for his insecurities. So
yes,
I don't know
why
I'm defending Gambit here.
I think you're right. But I think then making him be like the third wheel in a love triangle presses on that insecurity, helps push it to the surface in a way that makes him more compelling as a character.
Yeah, there's also something about this storyline that's going to be interesting to see how Rogue reckons with what happens. Because, you know, the argument that Magneto is making, whether explicitly or implicitly, is that like, you and I don't belong here. We're not the good guys, you know, we're like, we've got this baked in evil, we are outsiders here. And so even if the relationship doesn't like go anywhere with Magneto, that seed is planted in Rogue's mind. And I wonder whether that's going to play out in any way and whether she's going to feel as though she's not worthy, in inverted commas, of the team.
Yeah, I love that. I think that they could definitely go in that direction, and that would be so interesting to see because there's so much there. And they certainly have played with that a little bit in the original series too. Like there's a whole episode where we learn about the fact that like Rogue starts seeing visions of Carol Danvers and she learns all about how she's like accidentally trapped Carol Danvers in her mind. wild shit.
And that scene in the jet craft airplane, I'm not really sure, but the scene where, and Miss Marvel is driving the plane and Rogue takes her powers, and it's just, so good. So good.
And then in like the current day, like she has to have that confrontation with Mystique, and she's like, Mama, why'd you make me do it, Mama? And it's just like,
it's excellent. Oh, and she's the hospital. All these
really good. It's a really good episode. You should check out if you haven't watched it. But yeah, I think there's a lot of potential there. I also briefly want to say, you were talking earlier about like Magneto monologuing, and like, I mean, that's who he is, right? He has to monologue. So I'm not upset to see it, but I did like that. Like, he has this big long monologue with the rest of the team being like, if you can't accept me and trust me, then there's nothing I could do. Like, blah, blah, blah. And then Rogue just comes in later. It's just like, you know, instead of just like demanding everybody trust you, you could like, you know, try to like
be trustworthy,
earn their trust a little bit. It was like, yeah, that's right. So I liked that as like a contrast, you know. It's like she kind of cuts through all of that in just the span of like a couple of lines of dialogue. So let's put them aside, because I think we're going to have a lot more to say about Rogue and Magneto as the story progresses. So another unlikely couple is Jubilee and Bobby. Bobby DaCosta, who's a new character, kind of presents as a point of view character in that first episode. And it's sort of a nice parallel to where Jubilee started in the first episode of the original series. Now, these are two characters who are both known for being teenagers in X runs, but did completely different eras, right? Bobby is 80s New Mutant, Jubilee, a Gen Xer. What did you think about the choice to pair these people up in what is clearly supposed to be a kind of, you know, teen fling love affair?
Yeah, well, okay. So first of all, I didn't really like the throwback to Jubilee's introduction in the original series. I was like, oh, this is just the same thing, but with a different character. So I found that a bit weird. I just don't know about this pairing, like, because there's not really any history of the two characters interacting overly much within the books. So it's weird that they decided to go in this direction. They could have easily pulled a character from Gen X, Generation X, or somewhere else that Jubilee has more of a history or like more stories to pull from. So yeah, I'm not sure. But also Bobby seems to have disappeared after the first episode, so I'm not even sure if he's going to like show up again.
Right, although that's kind of classic X-Men, right? We talked about that in a previous episode. Sometimes the character's is not there and we just pretend like he doesn't exist for a week.
So I guess
that's the deal with Bobby.
Yeah, where do you see it going?
I think, so what I like is that they decided to give Jubilee a peer in this group. I think that's good, because it is kind of, in the original run, it's really just like her running around with a bunch of 30-year-olds, and then sometimes there's small children that she gets to tell a story to, and that's pretty much it. And so it's nice that she gets to have a fellow teen, you know? I do think the choice of Bobby is a very interesting one. I could kind of see, in the sense of like, they're both sort of like on the surface, a little bit superficial, you know, a little bit like trendy, you know, a little bit insecure with their powers when they first start. And so like, maybe there's a natural fit there. They both have kind of complicated family dynamics at home, but you could kind of say that about almost every teen X character. So I don't know why it had to be Bobby. I definitely think that like Jubilee is the most notable of the Generation X crew. So I understand maybe not wanting to pull one of them, but even like, I don't know, like it feels like there's other people that you could pull that would be an interesting pairing for her, even if in the comics they're not contemporaries, over Bobby. Like, it just seems like a really odd choice.
It's not even as though Bobby is a well-known character. Like, it's not as though like the general public who will be watching this cartoon will be like, oh yeah, I'm so excited that he's in it. Like, it just feels strange.
Yeah. And like I wonder if it's like they think that there's potential there for future stories with the Bobby DaCosta character, because he has the sort of like, you know, evil dad, and he's really rich, and he, like in the comics, he kind of goes back and forth between the light and the dark sides, like as an adult. And so maybe there's elements of it there, but I don't know. It seems kind of, and I guess in the comics, doesn't he have a relationship with Boom Boom for a while? And Jubilee and Boom Boom do have a kind of similar vibe in certain
the same character,
respects.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So maybe that's the idea is like, well, we'll just have Jubilee fill the Boom Boom role. But I kind of would have rather Jubilee and Boom Boom together. Like, that would be a fun pairing, right? Like, let's have the two separate characters.
Well, because, I mean, when you were talking about, like, who could replace Bobby, I think it should have been a female character. I think, like, that friendship is more interesting than a potential romantic relationship. I mean, not that Jubilee can't get it on with a woman, but you know, if you're thinking about those kind of teen characters, I would have loved to have seen someone like Armor or Husk, or just someone that is like less similar to Jubilee and brings a bit of tension for her. Because I think the thing about Generation X as a comic book and what made it work so well is that Jubilee had lots of experience as an X-Man, but she was still far less mature than a lot of the other characters in that book. And so she would always get kind of like pissed off about it because she felt like she should have been the leader. And that would have been a really interesting dynamic to explore.
I agree. Yeah. I don't know. I guess we'll have to see. I think we're really on the same page as being like, this doesn't quite add up yet, but maybe they have a story that they want to tell that with enough time, we'll get there.
Or maybe we'll never see Bobby again.
Sure, there's that too. I don't know. They were so flirty with each other. I can't imagine we're not going
to
see
them. And he did, I mean, I did appreciate his business card, I have to say. Yes. I'm thinking of getting my business cards made up just because of that scene.
And doesn't he tell her to page him at some point? That was a real nice 1997 moment.
Yeah.
Okay, well, next up on our list is Storm. Now, Storm doesn't get a pairing because she's a titanic force of nature, so she doesn't
with Storm
need to.
And the weather, maybe?
Yes, exactly. So you already alluded to the fact that she monologues a little bit and you found that a little bit ridiculous. I just like ate up every single line reading that she gives in an action scene. I just loved that we were back there when she's kind of running through the Sahara Desert and turning the sand into glass and using it to attack her enemy. It was just so epic. And I just loved so many of those moments because, you know, Storm was pretty formidable in the 90s cartoon. She was.
But
I feel like this ups it like quite a bit, and maybe because of where they were headed, where they really wanted us to remember just how powerful she was. But man, she was truly like, when the Sentinel was like, Omega level of threat detected, it's like, for sure, she totally sold herself as an Omega level threat here. I loved her so much. I loved the moment in the UN where she just like instantly takes charge of the situation, and the guy's like, why should we listen to you, and she just totally tells him to shut the fuck up, basically.
If you want to live, you will just so good. Yeah.
Just the confidence of her is incredible.
So yes, I do find the monologuing a little bit annoying, but in relation to Storm, I'll give her a pass because it's like high camp. It's like ridiculous. And it's also, one of the funnest things about the original cartoon is just that like Storm comes and gets it done. And like Storm is just the heart of everything.
And she talks like that and no one else talks like that. No one else announces their powers. No one else gives like a shady little dig before they get destroyed. And it's not commented upon. She's like, Storm's thing. That's what she does. And it's excellent every time.
What did you think about the letter that she wrote when she decided to leave? Oh, am I jumping ahead actually? Should we talk about the depowering before we talk about the letter?
Well, I guess there's a couple of key moments. Right, she's excellent in every action scene, so we have that on already. She has that moment with Jean in the first episode where she's talking to her about how important it is to be a mutant, and you really establish that like sisterly bond that the two of them have, which I thought was really lovely and well done.
Yeah, although I will say I thought it was a little funny that she was like, yeah, sometimes I think about like if I wasn't a mutant, like how my life would be different, and then I think about the fact that being a mutant brings me so many gift, like living in this mansion. And it's just like, what?
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it was touching and it was nice to see that moment of friendship between the two of them.
And also, I think it's, you know, we talk about kids' cartoons and stuff like that. That was just a scene, like a straight dramatic scene for like a solid 3 minutes of two animated characters sitting on a bed just talking about their feelings. And with the longer runtime, right, this isn't a 22-minute episode. This, both of these episodes were I think like 32 minutes long. with that little bit of extra time, you do get a chance to let those more dramatic moments breathe. And it feels like, I think it really helps deepen the characters. And I love that they gave themselves time for that. I like that the action scenes are a little bit longer and you get to see all the different powers and stuff like that. That's really fun. But I think that a show, even a kid's show, like, it needs those moments for you to really invest in those people and feel like they're real.
Yeah.
Way for it to pay off later. So obviously that monologue is a setup for, you know, the fact that she gets depowered, right? It's like very kind of A to B storytelling. I'm telling you why it's important to me that I'm a mutant. Oh no, now I'm not a mutant, right? But you could have done that in a much shorter way, you know, with only a couple of lines of dialogue, with a lot less emotion behind it. And it just would have felt a lot more perfunctory. But here it feels really emotional. It feels really earnest. It feels like you're learning a lot about their relationship together and also Storm's relationship to herself and Jean's relationship to her crazy life that she lives, you know? And that's just the sort of building blocks that separates a kind of silly action adventure show to something that will kind of stick with you, I think.
And it's what made the first show so successful, is that there was the through line with all the stories. It wasn't just like, this week we're doing this, this week we're doing this. It was like everything built and everything harked back to original plot lines.
Absolutely. And so now, moving forward to the sort of big moment when the executioner zaps Storm of her powers, I'm very excited by this development, only because it sets up a iconic story in the in the original comics, Life Death, which is a Chris Claremont, Barry Windsor Smith collab. Really beautiful comic book, really great storytelling. Sets Forge up as this, if you don't know, in the comics, there is a similar moment where Storm loses her powers and she goes and she ends up with this guy named Forge, who you've seen in a couple of episodes of the original series if you've watched it, but in kind of a weird way where it's kind of like he's just there and he knows technical stuff and you're just like, okay.
He's but, convenient for the plot. Oh no, he's not convenient for the plot now. Go away.
Exactly. So I wonder if we're going to actually go all the way with it. I mean, if you look ahead in the episode guide, ooh, you'll see there's two episodes with named Life Death, so there it seems like they're going all the way with it, and I love that because it's a really interesting choice to play that story in this cartoon
and a fascinating story from what I remember. So I read this a really long time ago. They form a bond and start to develop a relationship, and it's only at that point that Storm finds out that Forge was responsible for inventing the weapon that took away her powers. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct.
That is heartbreaking. Yeah, I'd love to see that in the cartoon.
If we're looking at her storylines and things that are somewhat like loosely contemporary to the 90s, you know, in that 80s, 90s range, like what's a story that you can pull out of there that would give Storm some really meaty, juicy material? I mean, Life Death, I don't think you get better than that, you know?
Well, yeah. And then the follow-up storyline about securing leadership of the team, even though she's depowered. That is amazing. Kicking Scott's butt, yeah. So I hope that so comes good. In.
I do too. Yeah, I'm so excited because we really have never gotten a live action Storm that's worth the who she is in the comics, you know? And certainly there's been other like animated series that have tried to capture that, like in X-Men Evolution, which is a show that kind of came after X-Men, the animated series. She like plays a teacher at the school. Like she's like, they weirdly decide to like, Storm and Wolverine are adults and all the other X-Men are teens for some reason.
I can't remember what the character's like in Wolverine and the X-Men, because I loved that cartoon. That
I've only watched a few episodes of that, so I'm not really an expert on that topic.
Yeah, I mean, like that just went completely left field and just completely ripped up the rule book. But that was a good cartoon. But it's not the one that we're here to talk about. So sorry, I'm taking us off.
But yeah, so that's the bottom line. Is I loved her in these two episodes, and I'm so excited to see that they have chosen to walk down this path.
And yeah, keep the camp levels at 100.
Yes. And I mean, if we're talking over the top, like it's so over the top for her to be like, it's heartbreaking, but it's also so extra for her to be like, now that I'm not a mutant, we are living different lives and walking down different paths and I can never see you again. It's like so extra.
And I hope you understand. I can't tell you this in person. I'm going to write this very long letter.
I feel like we all know people like that. And it's all very true to life. It's like, okay, how about you just like come back home and we'll talk for 5 minutes?
Yeah, or like maybe, like think about it for a day or two.
Yeah, like we could, you're still the city, you're still Aurora. Like we could talk about it, we could calm down, but it's like, it's too late. My life is completely different now and I have to leave. Like, okay, so I love that. It's because it's so sad, but it's also so extra, as I said. But okay, speaking of extra, ooh, we're going to move to our last kind of group of characters, and I'm putting them as extras because they had nothing to do in these episodes, really, and that would be Beast, Gambit, and Bishop. So I love that Bishop gets to be part of the opening credits now. That's awesome for him. All three of these characters had some fun action beats, but otherwise mostly had nothing else to do. I mean, Gambit, there's like one moment where he's like, he notices that Rogue and Magneto are kind of like talking in hushed tones, and he's like, but that's pretty much as far as it goes.
But well, I mean, he also got to show off his midriff.
Well, yeah, that's so important, Kay, and I'm glad that you are reminding everyone about
it. I mean,
that.
I think that was like the most important plot point.
I agree. If there's a one thing that we can all agree on, it's that his crop top is the most important thing that happened this week on television.
So of these three, I'm less offended by Beast and Gambit because I always felt like Beast was kind of a supporting character in the original series. I mean, there were a few episodes, obviously, where he was the most prominent character and that focused on him. But otherwise, he was kind of there to be like, oh, isn't this interesting? Let me look in the lab. And Gambit, like, you know, he had that original kitchen scene in the first episode. I didn't feel like there was not enough Gambit. But fuck me, Bishop was totally screwed over in these episodes. He showed up at the end of the fight scene in the UN and I was like, oh, you're in this show as well. Like, oh, what? But he didn't even say anything. He was just like in a shot. I do not know why they have this character in this show if they're not going to use him. It feels,
I know, his entire job in these two episodes is to show up in action scenes and get blasted with energy weapons so that way then he can just like send out a big energy beam.
Yeah.
And then that's it. Like that's he can't have more than 4 lines of dialogue in the entire 2 episodes combined.
Yeah, which is such a disservice to his character.
Yeah, especially because when people heard that he was going to be part of the main cast, I think everyone was really excited by that because he's such a popular character and there's so much you can do with him. And he does play some pretty important roles in a few key episodes in the original series. The idea that he would be getting the bump, that's huge. And I mean, look, I'm sure that in the future, there's going to be episodes that are going to be focusing on him more. I can't imagine that he's just this sidelined in every episode, but
because you know, in the first episode, they did so much work in like cramming every character and introducing every character and bringing you up to speed with where they were at. Why didn't
except
they do that?
For Bishop?
Yeah, except for Bishop.
Because
like
even Beast, you get a couple, like you said, you get moments of him in the lab. You get the sense of like, oh, he's the smart one. He knows how to do tech stuff. You get Beast gets a moment to explain that Bishop is a time traveler and has time travel tech instead of giving Bishop a moment to talk about that. Like Bishop doesn't get any, I don't think he gets a single line of dialogue outside of action sequences. Like you don't understand his relationship connections to anyone on the team at all. There's no sense of like, this is the guys that we hang out with. This is the member of the team that I get annoyed by. There's no chemistry with it. Like he gets literally no opportunity. Like Morph gets action moments, and then Morph gets a few scenes with Wolverine where you get to know, oh, Morph and Wolverine are friends. Morph has a sense of humor. Like everyone gets that. Bobby DaCosta gets that. Bishop gets literally nothing at all.
Yeah, and it's so weird. But maybe it's because like the character of Bishop has lots of tension with the character of Wolverine, and maybe like they were using Wolverine. Because I can't really think of any of the other characters that he has lots of interactions with in the comic. I mean, but Bishop is just like that, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a weird choice.
When Bishop is first introduced in the comics, he has a lot of tension with Gambit because he's like his whole thing of he was sent back in time to find who the X-Traitor was.
Oh, of course.
The person who betrayed the X-Men. And he thinks that Gambit is the guy who screws over everyone because Gambit has this dark secret. But it turns out that's not Gambit's dark secret. It's a different dark secret. And actually, it turns out the X-Traitor was Professor X, his alter ego, Onslaught. So Bishop was wrong. But they did have tension in the comics there for a little while. So you could do that. But you could also just do anything you wanted, honestly. You know, like, he's been interacting with these characters off and on in the original series long enough that you could just have him call back to their shared history a couple of times in a scene or two, you know?
Or just be like in random scenes, like when Bobby was in the ward. I don't know, that's the wrong word. But when, like, they rescued him and he was in the bed, like, there were a few people gathered around the bed. Why couldn't Bishop have been there being like, oh, we're just worried about you, or like some bullshit? Like, there were bits where you could have injected him into a scene and it wouldn't have felt really inorganic, but they didn't because they used characters that were already being utilized in other scenes. Yeah, it's just weird.
It's very strange. So we'll have to see how that develops. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so that's all of the characters. We also, they did something funny where they included Professor X in the intro sequence in episode one. And I thought, like, oh, wow, are they like kind of letting us know that he's actually going to be alive and coming back at some point? And then in the second episode, they put Magneto in that slot and they don't have Professor X in the opening sequence.
Yeah, okay, oh good. Because there were some additional scenes in the opening sequence for the second episode, and I was like, oh shit, was I not paying attention?
Yeah, no, they added a couple of things and took a couple things away, yeah. So it'll be interesting to see if that develops. I mean, Professor X known to fake his death, so I'm not convinced that we're not going to see him pop back up eventually.
They are all drama queens.
Yeah, that's going to do it in terms of our conversation. We were going to talk about our favorite moment from each episode, but I feel like we kind of hit it by now. Is there any extra moment that you'd like to talk about before we move on to another episode?
Yes. I think we have not given enough attention and appreciation for the closing sequence.
Okay.
The opening sequence, the theme song, everyone talks about that, how amazing it is, how exciting it is. The fact that they recreated the original closing sequence when there's the like really shitty animation of the mouse like going across and selecting different characters, yes, and then those characters spinning and you seeing what their powers were, that sent me. That was just like, oh, wow. This is so amazing. This is unlocking so many memories.
I couldn't believe that they did it. I love that they did it. That oftentimes we get cut from an actual episode of X-Men because they would kind of like, you know, get the credits off the screen and tease the next show that was coming on and stuff like that. So you very rarely even saw it. And then when you watch it on Disney Plus, the original series of Disney Plus, sometimes you'll get that. And then other times they'll do like a tease for the next episode, which is really funny because a lot of episodes were not aired in order. So they'll tease you for a new episode that isn't coming for like half a season. So it's particularly funny. But yeah, I was shocked by that. I did not think we were getting a revisit of that. And I love that they did it in such a faithful way where, like you said, we get the mouse dragging across the screen and everything. It's like just iconic
wonderful.
90s.
Wonderful.
90s bullshit.
Loved it. Loved it. The only other thing that I didn't say, and this, like, okay, so you were the person that was talking about political things going on and how this show was representing them in the world of the X-Men. The thing that really hit me the hardest was when Sunspot was originally captured and was like tied up and whatever, and he said to his captors, no, I'm not like them, I'm one of the good ones. Yeah. And that was me like, oh, I've heard that so many times from queer men who are like, oh no, I'm not like the other gays, I'm like good. And that, yeah, that was the one that evoked the most emotion from me.
Yeah, I definitely relate to that. I feel, you know, that's on our podcast that we did on the episode of Lost Spaces that I did on For You, that I think I talked about that a lot, that kind of feeling of being like the only queer person in a space and wanting to kind of make it clear that, like, you know, like to be a good representative and also like, you know, all that kind of stuff. And yeah, that is so heartbreaking, right? And you hope that the journey that character goes on is understanding that, like, you need to just reject that outright, the idea that, like, there's good ones and bad ones. Like, we're all just people, and you don't need to feel that pressure of being a good mutant, because also, like, fuck the people who think mutants and bad mutants, because they probably, the way they're defining that is bullshit, you know?
Yeah.
But being a kid and not getting it, and just, like, and we learn later on that, like, he's, like, he hasn't come out to his family about being a mutant. He doesn't really, he's afraid of his powers. He's afraid of, like, acknowledging what he's capable of because of that internalized, like, bigotry, right? That's the only way that you can kind of refer to it, like that internalized anti.
What do you call it? Is it mutophobia?
I don't know. I don't know if there's a formal name for it, but yeah, that hits hard. Yeah, and of course we're talking about queer stuff because obviously that's the community that we're coming from. I think a lot of other marginalized groups in society can probably relate to those ideas as well, you know. And I don't want to speak for them, obviously, because that's not my experience, but I could definitely say that I believe that a statement like that is something that probably universally an understanding from, you know, marginalized groups, persecuted groups, that feeling of trying to kind of like define yourself as not the person that these people want to hurt in a way that ends up, you know, validating their bigotry out of your own sense of.
But yeah, and just by compromising your own self as well.
Yeah.
And like this.
And boxing yourself in by letting these people define what good and bad even is.
Yeah. Well, and like, and defining yourself so much by what you're not rather than what you are.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. Yeah, it's a great moment. And I'm excited that we're getting moments like that because I just really wasn't sure how they would go. They have ideas on their mind. They're trying to live up to that expectation that X-Men is about the silly stuff and it's about the serious stuff and that there's room for both. And I think they hit the balance really well. I was very surprised that they nailed it as much as they did.
You can definitely learn something while staring at Gambit's midriff.
Yes, you might learn a lot about yourself by doing that.
The two things are not opposed. Like, yeah,
absolutely. So, Kay, thanks so much for doing this. This was so much fun. We definitely went longer than we anticipated, but we did have two episodes to talk about. So,
yeah, there's that.
It'll be shorter next time, guys, probably.
maybe. Unless we spend like half an hour looking for Bishop.
Yes, yeah. I hope that that is not a recurring segment on this show. So where did Bishop go this week? But yeah, I don't know. So did you, after talking about this show for an hour and a half with me, do you like it more?
Oh, how funny, though. We've talked about the show more than I watched the show. You've definitely sparked lots of thoughts and things that like didn't really like register for me or that I hadn't really examined. So I'm going to stay non-committal and say I'm going to have to go away and think about it. But there's definitely much more for me to think about.
Very good. Well, I'm going to keep chipping away at you. Hopefully you'll come over to my side by the end.
I didn't say it was terrible. I just said, like, you know, I'm just, you know, percolating. I'm working through some things.
But in the meantime, can you tell everyone where we can find more of your work out there on the internet?
Oh, sure. So the show I host is called Lost Spaces, and that is available on all podcast platforms. So just type in that title and you'll find it. And then if you want to follow me on socials, the best place to get me is on Instagram, Lost Spaces Pod, but I'm also occasionally on Facebook doing the same things, Lost Spaces Pod.
Awesome. Okay, as for me, you can follow me on Letterboxd at Media Thinkings. You can follow me on Blue Sky at Alex Marcus. And you can follow my X-Men podcast that I've been doing for the next couple of months. It's Bill versus the MCU. It's an MCU Marvel rewatch podcast. The next couple of months, we're going to be doing all sorts of X-Men stuff. We've done the original X-Men trilogy. We've done the prequel trilogy. Next month, we're going to be doing the Disney discarded double feature of X-Men Dark Phoenix and X-Men The New Mutants. So definitely check that out on Pop Break Today podcast feed. And then, yeah, just go on to thepopbreak.com, click on the podcast tab. I'm the podcast director, so I have a little bit of a hand in everything going on over there. And there's lots of fun podcasts from reality shows, movies, music, TV, all sorts of fun stuff. So check out all that stuff. And until next time, Kay, thanks so much.
Thank you. See you next week.
See you next week.